I am calling Jay from his home in Stoughton, and I'm here in UW-Madison. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And Jay, I managed to not record most of that, so I just need to quickly say that this is October 26, 2012, and this is the third interview with Jay Hathaway. All right, we are now recording, Jay, so if you wouldn't mind, so I can check the sound levels, if you could say your name and then spell your last name.
Okay, Jay Hathaway, H-A-T-H-E-W-A-Y.
Perfect, thank you. Jay, I gave you a list via email of some of the things I wanted to talk about in this final session. The first two things are things that you mentioned at the end of the last interview, so I want to ask how you got involved in this governor's task force, and then if you could give even a bit more of an overview than you did at the end of the last interview. So if we could start with that, that'd be great.
Well, I think that my association with the task force was ultimately a consequence of my organization among friends, which was, as we may recall, this statewide outreach to rural gays and lesbians in the state of Wisconsin. And I had developed a network of doctors and social workers who would work with rural gays and lesbians if needed. And in particular, I zeroed in on the issue of HIV and began to share information that I had gained from this network of doctors with people in rural areas who contacted me. And eventually that got back to the Department of Health and Human Services. And the Department of Health and Human Services here in Madison then asked me to help them do continued rural outreach, and via that department, then the governor's office got wind of me, and eventually a person by the name of Ivy Bai contacted me by phone and said that we have heard the work you're doing with Among Friends for Rural Gays and Lesbians. Would you like to be a voice for those people on this council that Governor Thompson is putting together, the HIV Infection Advisory Council? And I said, sure, why not? And so that was really the way in which I became affiliated with the council that Governor Thompson had established. Then, when the council was up and running, and, you know, I'm going to have to guess this would have been the late 80s, maybe 87, 88, somewhere in there. Then when the council was up and running, and there were members of it from all over the state, it was a pretty broadly based council, then the council's job was effectively to help the state develop policies to deal with HIV. And as you may recall, back in the 80s, HIV was not only a new disease, but it was also a very frightening disease. And so we had a number of very disparate people, both on the council and who would eventually come before the council as we moved around the state, hearing testimony from different peoples as to what to do. In the main, I would argue that the council was generally very favorable towards medicalizing HIV as opposed to stigmatizing HIV, which is what some people in the larger Wisconsin community wanted to do with those who were HIV positive. And in fact, some members of the council itself were inclined to turn it into some sort of a stigma, perhaps even warranting jail time of all things. But I would say, to the credit of the council, in the end it became a sounding board ultimately for the medical community of Wisconsin, and it was really the first real attempt on the part of the state to get a handle on what to do, not so much about what the disease was, because that of course is a real medical thing, but just from a public policy position. And so that was how I got onto it, and that my contribution was, in fact, as it turned out, the only openly gay person on the council, and the council maybe had 25 people or so. That was an interesting experience, actually.
Jay, from that, did you build a network of or increase your network of people that you knew around the state that I don't know, either allies or advocates for LGBT issues?
Yeah, I think so. sort of unbeknownst to me at the time, perhaps not surprisingly, unbeknownst to me at the time, when we went around and people would come and talk to us and we'd go seek people out, et cetera, et cetera, people were obviously talking about HIV, but they were also talking a little bit about Among Friends, because I was a member of the council as the director of Among Friends. It wasn't actually until after I shut Among Friends down that I discovered that there were a lot of isolated gays and lesbians who were looking forward to maybe another presence of Among Friends or another issue with the paper or some other communication in some fashion, although it was never really made explicit. But I would find out within the year or two afterwards that a number of gay people, men and women, were waiting on, or at least they became familiar with the services and thus were able to make links. And indeed, I'm not sure if I mentioned this, just shortly after I shut it down, I actually got a call from the Phil Donahue Show, of all places, asking that I come and talk about how it was that I was able to get these gays and lesbians, because apparently a number of gays and lesbians had in the meantime moved out to California, and the word got around, and bingo, got back to me here in Wisconsin. However, at the time, I shut the organization down. So yeah, I would say that it expanded, and it got more people talking. Of course, after everything was shut down, the life for gays and lesbians in some significant ways, I think, got much better. And ultimately, the services were either taken over by other people or just simply weren't needed because the state took them over.
Okay. So did you appear on the Phil Donahue Show?
I did not.
Okay.
Not.
Just wanted to make sure, you know, we want to make sure we got your 15 minutes of fame on the on the recording.
Yeah.
So you've been talking about Among Friends, and you've talked about it in previous interviews. And again, you talked about this at the end of the second interview, but if I want to give you space to talk more about it if you want, and that's the lawsuit that I believe you filed against the Gannett Incorporation or Gannett Newspapers Incorporated.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience, one I hadn't anticipated. We had, to rely upon newspaper ads to tell constituents who and what we were, the Green Bay Press, Gazette, and there were about two dozen newspapers. I've actually forgotten what they were anymore, but they were papers around the state, and I wanted them to run a little ad saying, Among Friends, help and support a rural GLBT or some such like that. And over the course of a number of months, the newspapers refused to, simply citing no, that was their right not to do so. When I would contact them and talk with their people, and it became clear they didn't do so because they thought that what I was doing was trying to put an ad in for a gay porno site and or some set of gay prostitution ring a gay porno site. And, oh, my goodness, we couldn't possibly do that in one thing or another similar to that. And when I tried to explain to them that wasn't the case, they didn't really care. And I then was friends with Mark Bornes, who I'd known from my early days in Madison, and he was a gay and lesbian ally who was an attorney, and who, by the way, at one time actually worked with Tammy Baldwin when Tammy had just received her law degree. In fact, she was one of the very early attorneys, as I recall, on this case where we sued Gannett, the newspaper that owned the Green Bay Press Gazette, for discrimination. Now, the way we began this was we went to the state and we took advantage of the state's anti-discrimination statute dealing with public accommodations. And the state actually found that these newspapers classified ad sections, and we were very specific as to the classified ad section as being a marketplace as opposed to an editorial place. And Mark Bornes had found legal precedent that that could be done. The state found that these papers, and Gannett in particular, had discriminated against me on the basis of sexual orientation, and that we could then go forward with a suit based upon discrimination. Gannett then came back and countered that a newspaper in toto, not with respect to various portions of its paper, but in toto, was covered by the First Amendment and freedom of the press, and therefore did not have to run ads in its classified section, irregardless and irrespective of what the state had previously determined. Now, this was a bit of a brouhaha because it became fairly well known both here in Madison and across the state, and it was sort of intriguing because I think his name was John Kovalik, who was a cartoonist with the Wisconsin State Journal or Cap Times, one of the two, I forget which now, did a cartoon that was sort of lambasting the whole issue of Among Friends and the press and whatever. It was really cute. But nevertheless, we were deadly serious. We had no other vehicle. The newspapers ultimately would be victorious. We were not surprised, given the strength of the First Amendment rights of newspapers. It was probably the best decision, to be honest with you. But we thought we would give it a go because the papers were being really pig-headed. They were actually sort of crude about it. I hadn't anticipated the difficulty in convincing these papers that this was basically a public service, and far from refusing it, they should run them for free. Well, of course, that went nowhere. So this issue lasted probably a year almost. During the process, a lot of energy was taken up, but Mark Borens did a pro bono. It was really nice of him. I think the contribution of Tammy Baldwin was also with pro bono. We got some help from gay advocates across the country, from New York and around in Los Angeles, and it was in the form of some money and mostly in the form of briefs and the like. The Lambda Education Fund, I think is what it was called in the past, is an organization that was prepared to give us as much aid as we needed, and it turned out this particular organization was established out of Janesville, where one of the Parker Penn heirs was a gay person who had found out about it and was willing to contribute, and actually was the founder of this Lambda Education Fund. I'm sure I have that name not exactly right. He later, by the way, was murdered by his partner, unfortunately. What a shock that was. But we went forward, and then in the end, the state was forced then to revise its anti-discrimination statute so that newspaper were absolutely exempted from this sort of suit, and the newspapers were exempted from claims of discrimination based on the First Amendment. So it was a loss. But that's sort of the long and the short of that event.
Thank you, Jay. A couple of things off of that. First, did this lawsuit feel different than your court martial? I guess what I'm trying to ask is, I mean, it sounds like it was a pretty prominent, interesting, stressful lawsuit, and you'd already sort of gone through something somewhat similar. I'm wondering if there were what effects, if any, it had on you.
Well, from my perspective, I would argue that the court martial was background for allowing me to say full speed ahead. Mm. By the time I was involved with the newspaper suit, I had it up to my keister with discrimination against gays. Now, not mentioned in our conversations, I don't think, is that before I came out to Wisconsin, I might have mentioned this briefly, before I came out to Wisconsin, I was in California at a school called the Monterey Institute of International Studies. And not only did the institute want to deny me my master's degree in international studies in German, where I was hired, which was Monterey, California Public Library, as a part-time job, working in the library. The library fired me when they found out about my court-martial for moral turpitude, and the college wanted to refuse to give me my diploma because of moral turpitude. And in the master's program, I was a magna cum laude, and I shared the stage with, at the time, Congressman Panetta, and God, I was outraged about that. So I had the trial follow me to California, and in California, irrespective that it was not military in the day, they wanted to dump me because of this trial saying that anyone who gets a diploma or anybody who works for the library can't do it because of this trial. I did get my diploma. I did not get my job back. I came out to Wisconsin. And then once again, I ran into this issue. And by now, with the newspaper, I was fed up right up to the top. Basically, come on, people. Where in the hell are you people coming from? What is this issue? So by 1988, 89, I was ready to take on the newspapers. I was charged. And I mean, Mark Borns was very realistic. He didn't think that in the end, we cross our fingers, the chances of really winning were not that great. But what it did is it drew attention to a very serious deficit on the part of Wisconsin, and that was a deficit of gay and lesbian acceptance, even in spite of the fact 1982 was the year that David Clarenbaugh's work on anti-discrimination and public accommodations became law. 6 years later, the state was still not particularly comfortable with public gays and lesbians. So, no, it actually, all that earlier stuff just sort of geared me up to fight and to say, come on, I'll take you guys on, in spite of the fact that we lost.
Okay. Thank you for that, Jay. The other thing that this brings up, you mentioned Tammy Baldwin a couple of times in your first answer, and then in the governor's task force, that was Governor Tommy Thompson, so I think I'd feel remiss if I didn't ask just your general thoughts or opinions on the two of them that are running against each other now for a seat in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, it's really funny. Well, from a political point of view, I mean, Tommy Thompson was when he was governor, he was sort of an okay guy. He was a guy from God knows where. He didn't speak very good English. Everything began with a duh. He was a slappy on the back. He was just one of these guys who reminded me very much of my dad's generation. Everything was sort of black and white. And then every now and then, okay, he didn't seem to have any mean bones in him. He was not particularly comfortable with gays and lesbians, but he wasn't uncomfortable either. And for example, when our report was finally issued, we had this huge press conference in the governor's office, and he wanted me to come front and center and stand next to him as the cameras were rolling, and I looked at him and said, no, you know, this is your business, go ahead, and oh, come on up, you know, slap on the back and guffaw. And so, okay, I mean, the guy was, I don't know, he was okay, but he certainly wasn't a person, in my opinion, who, I never really got the impression he really had a grip on what this was. I always thought it was a bit more of a public relations thing. Maybe well-intentioned, perhaps, but nevertheless a bit of a public relations ploy. And what I was sort of impressed by was that he looked like he wanted to reach out to lots of different constituents, especially with respect to HIV, because no one really knew precisely where and how and what or whatever. It was a little unknown factor. So he came across, I suppose you would say, as one of these Republican moderates, and you hear the word today, Eisenhower moderates. And that's how I looked at him, because I was a little bit, I was actually way to the left, and I was very suspicious at first, but hey, what the hell. He was nice enough, and we all had lunches together and sometimes a dinner here and there, and there was never any really bitterness or any deep ideological cleavage. It seemed to be a practical approach to do the right thing, and I liked it in spite of the fact that it was a Republican governor and Tommy Thompson in particular. And Tammy and I, of course, and again, I don't want to overstress the fact we're not best buds or anything, but we have known each other now for pushing 30 years. We cross every now and then. I mentioned before that she came to my office to give me this redlined edition of legislation ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We were initially sort of paired back in the day, which I would say early 80s or so, and even doing Among Friends Day, on issues related to gay and lesbian stuff. And one of the mediators, I suppose, that we work with sometime would be David Clarenbaugh, who was in the State Assembly. And we would give talks from time to time. Tammy was on this this council, Gay and Lesbian Council, that Governor Tony Earle had put together with Earl Bricker and all these people. I don't even know what happened to Earl Bricker. And this was way back in the day. And in that capacity, also from time to time, I would talk with Tammy. And indeed, she got funding for me to develop a program for it as an in-service program for teachers in the Madison School District that would sensitize them to gay and lesbian issues, because one young student had been severely bullied and harassed. And working through PCADA, we developed a an in-service for high school teachers, and I suppose you would call them counselors, to make them more aware, perhaps, of gay and lesbian bullying. So, obviously, Baldwin, in her days with the Gay and Lesbian Council, I think she was on it, and then working with, she might have been an advisor to it, actually, and she was in the state assembly. When she became very politically active, I didn't see her so much, but it was sort of interesting to see her go that career. And so every now and then our paths would cross. And as I said, most recently it was just last year.
Great. Again, thank you for that. I want to shift now to your time at Edgewood, which is now 20 years, I believe.
23. Yeah.
Great. Well, congratulations. First off, I want to talk about, at the end of the interview, you said, you know, moving to Stoughton and then getting the job at Edgewood sort of took you out of Madison gay and lesbian politics. So my question is, what sort of things did you do to advance LGBT issues, or what they now sort of all fall in the umbrella of social justice? What sort of things at Edgewood were you trying to do, or were you trying to do those things while there?
Yeah, I was trying to do those things, and I had to make a decision as to sort of a fork in the road. Do I want to continue with the gay stuff outside of academics, or do I really want to pursue academics, which after all is why I came to Wisconsin in the first place? So I decided that I would reluctantly put Among Friends to bed and dive into my academic career. So the way it started is I had a long conversation with a number of the sisters, the nuns who were sponsoring Edgewood, about whether or not I would be received well as a gay person. I was very upfront about that. And the response was absolutely the issue of gays, lesbian is not our issue. We're not that kind of religious institution. In fact, the phrase they used, that our issues are issues of the heart, not of the hip. And I thought that was pretty funny. Mm-hmm. So when I became chair, when I started to work for Edgewood, I was part-time. And I had a number of jobs while I was part-time. I was archivist. I was also a member of what is called the Human Issues Committee, which deals with academic content that relates to human issues, of which gay and lesbian stuff was one. And later I became the interim director. And in the capacity of an interim director of this small program, my job was to make sure that the program went out smoothly and that courses or seminars were offered that impacted and reflected human issues like divorce, drug abuse, racism, and, wow, look at this, homosexuality as well. So as director, I then myself developed a seminar on gay identity. It was the first one the school had, and then I let it be known that I was a gay faculty member, and so I then began to press other faculty and administration for inclusion of some very basic things like statements of non-discrimination based on sexual orientation. And indeed, the school was ready for it. There were some staff who were a little uncomfortable, and there were some faculty, but our mission statement and the values that the institution espouses are one of compassion and all this sort of stuff. And so it was really up the school's alley, especially since after talking with some of the sisters, this was an issue that was just right. It was just ripe as well. So my first thing was to get the seminar up and going, construction and gay identity, and it was a one-year seminar. I did it three times. Then it was to work to get a statement of non-discrimination in the catalog and the faculty handbook. And over the course of the next couple of years, those issues then were developed. And now in addition to the statement of non-discrimination, which would be prominent, I also, in my capacity of this human issues director, this program, again, that allows students to reflect upon basic values, I got my students to apply for the establishment of a gay and lesbian student club. And the student club in the day was known as Friends Like Us. And Friends Like Us was chartered under my aegis. I was the faculty advisor and faculty founder. And it was done with my human issues study group. And they had to do all the paperwork. They had to go before the requisite authorities to get it approved. And each club has to have officers. They have to have bylaws. So all that stuff was written. And then within maybe the fourth semester of my being at Edgewood, Edgewood had its first gay and lesbian organization called Friends Like Us. And I thought it was really sort of humorous because somewhere along the line I had to go to a series of conferences at UW, and in the conferences was Joanne Elder, of all people. And along telling this story about establishing the club and the non-discrimination and establishing this course on gay identity, she made the observation that Edgewood was even ahead of UW with respect to this public commitment to things gay and lesbian. Well, of course, things have changed in the day, and Edgewood is actually, we still have the club, and there's still gay and lesbian students, but Edgewood is so small, and the students tend to be fairly well integrated. It is no longer much of an issue, although back in the late 80s and 90s, there was a good amount of discrimination against gay men primarily, although some gay women who let it be known, particularly those who lived in the dormitories. And initially, many of the gay men and women found that they had to leave the dorms because they were harassed. And I worked with the dean of students very quickly to put the kibosh on that one. Now, 20-some-odd years later, it doesn't seem to be an issue. Gay men and gay women at Edgewood are fairly well integrated. In fact, this weekend, as we speak, we're having a series of gay mini-plays, and every year we have a drag show. So that's that.
Okay. The other thing I want to ask, or make sure I ask, is about your publications.
Okay.
So I think it's probably appropriate for us to start with the one that would be sort of most germane to the LGBT, and that's the Gilded Age of Construction.
Okay.
And American Homophobia. Now, if you want to just sort of give an overview of your publications while at Edgewood and while focusing on that one to start, why don't we try something like that?
Okay. Well, I've authored three books, two of which have gay themes, and the one, The Gilded Age Construction of Modern American Homophobia, in some ways is the monograph that says everything I want to say about issues related to gays, in particular, why gays are disliked. Now, the book is the story, if you will, about the American experience discovering the modern equivalent of the homosexual. And what it does is it traces the emergence within the United States of public awareness. I do not mean gay men themselves or gay women so much as those outside of the growing small gay community, who these people were, why they're here, what causes it. And the reason in part that I wrote the book was, of course, my own experience, how come they hate gays so much. But it was also part of a larger issue that I really actually enjoy, which is part of my other academic work dealing with the Nazis and the Holocaust, is this issue of essentialism when it comes to character and, let's call it, ethnicity, in this case, sexuality. And so the book, then, is a study of the initial reaction to two gays by the professional community, mostly medical, which was just forming, and how homosexuality was perceived to be the result of modernization and the stresses that modernization places on the nervous system, which in turn creates freaks of nature, and like canaries in the proverbial mine, these freaks of nature, these gay people, are a sign that culture is veering off in the wrong direction. And in the end of the 19th century, going into the 20th century, everybody was talking about the decay of civilization, and especially in Europe, but in France and in England, and to an extent here as well. Everything was going to hell in a handcart, and gay people got caught up in that larger dialogue, so that they could not be looked at by those outside as strictly a phenomenon in and of themselves. They were viewed from the context of a society that was in crisis as a consequence of modernization and industrialization. The other thing that I found interesting was that the medical community, which is what I focused on, in discussing what it meant to be gay with their patients, would discuss and elicit from their quote-unquote gay patients what all this syndrome was. And so the medical and neurological community was learning what it meant to be gay from their patients themselves. And this is where I tended to fall back upon Michel Foucault's understanding of power based upon the medical community's capacity to label, and then looking at patients and then asking patients to confirm the label they applied to these people, especially since the patient doesn't quite know exactly the nature of his or her condition. In addition, most of the people who were being interviewed by the medical community were middle class and upper class, and these people, except for their odd sexual orientation, were people of the community. They were businessmen, they were doctors, they were lawyers, all these new gay people, and they were given a pretty good bill of health except for their biological problem of homosexuality. But when they began to look at poor people who were gay or lesbian, they were not biological freaks. They were conceived as choosing an immoral path and being purposely immoral, because lower class people by nature are immoral. So there was a duality then upon how the community of doctors and neurologists would look at gay people, upper middle class, biological freaks, not their fault, they're fine, outstanding people, but for this sad condition. Lower class people, well, if they choose to do so, they're immoral, and that's part of what it meant to be a lower class, and so that's to be expected. So that's sort of what the book was about. Then the ultimate premise is, how do we get to where we are today in terms of homophobia? Because the homophobia I had experienced, I had to ask that question. Why do people hate gay people so much? What's this nonsense all about? And I chose not to go the religious route. I figured that religious homophobia is pretty self-explanatory. But what wasn't so clear was the cultural, non-religious, secular manifestations of it, and the manifestations of secular homophobia are related then to the crisis of modernization and the crisis of the Gilded Age that many Americans experienced in the 1880s and 1890s. Wow, how's that?
That was very nice. Now, Jay, I know you've gotten some, every book that everybody writes gets some criticism, but
yes.
I'm wondering if you could address, because I know we talked about it in the pre-interview.
The two criticisms which I found interesting. One was, and that was the most common one, was I over-contextualized. I was so busy contextualizing why this occurred that I sort of lost sight of what I was trying to do. Well, of course, the whole book was an attempt to contextualize. I guess the reviewer, and I actually emailed her and said, well, that was the whole point, was to contextualize. University of Wisconsin-Madison, history is a department is like one of the oldest in the country, and they had the first PhD in history, and they're all trained by Germans, George Massey, for example, but the program itself is historical from Germany, and that means that the German School of Historiography, which is the modern school of historiography established in the 1850s by a guy named Leopold von Ranke, was the first person to make historians ask the question, What was it like? Put yourself in their shoes. You want to know what was going on? Then become those people. Put yourself back in the 1850s or 1760s. I was trained that way, and it's been very useful. You put yourself in the shoes of people back in the day, and then you ask yourself, well, how come you feel the way you do? And then you look around, and you begin to study all aspects of the culture in the time. The biggest criticism I had was that I did too much of that. And quite frankly, that just simply leaves me for a loop. I just don't understand that. But for some readers, they don't like that at all. Okay, that was one criticism. Another criticism was I didn't understand the nature of homosexuality sufficiently well from the history of same-sex attraction. And again, I'm guilty of that. Here I am, I'm justifying myself, but here I'm guilty of that because that's not what I wanted to do. I was very explicit. This is not a story about gay people. This is a story about homophobia. And I did not purposely spend much time talking about the development of gay communities or the development of gay self-awareness. I just didn't do that. That wasn't my interest. Quite frankly, I assume there have always been gay people. What I was intrigued by is how they were received by the public. So that's one criticism. And the last one, the third group, was I gave too many quotes. And therefore, too academic. So those are the three main areas that struck me the most.
Okay.
For criticism.
Jay, do you want some space here to talk about your other two publications?
Not necessarily. One, the other book is a memoir of my court martial, and it's called Guilty as Charged. What is it called? A gay memoir. It's called Guilty as Charged. It's sort of a funny how this occurred. The True Story of the Gay Beret, and it's published by GLB Press out of, I don't know where, back west somewhere. It's a story of my court martial, and for better or for worse, it actually won an award. In 1 year back in the day, it was published about 10 years ago. It won an award in the category of 2001, in the category of autobiography, and the people who awarded it were editors of the, I guess it's New York Times Book Supplement or something like that. Now, the publisher, it's a self-published, well, I didn't publish it, but it's a subsidized publisher out of San Francisco that publishes books that people won't touch. And I wrote this initially for UW Press by Rafi Kadushin. Do you know Rafi?
I know of.
Okay. So Rafi Kadushin contacted me to write a memoir of my court martial. George Massey was writing something or had completed writing something before he died. And apparently the conversation came up at the time that maybe I should do something too. So Rafi got me doing it. And then when I submitted it, he didn't like it. His reviewer didn't like what it was that I was writing, and I wasn't about to change it. I didn't like the direction they wanted me to go, and I said I wouldn't. I would just finish it because, for me, it was almost therapeutic. But then I contacted this publisher out of San Francisco who said, sure, we'll publish it, and it's made some pretty good money, actually. It's made several thousand dollars. And then he submitted this to a contest for memoirs that was national in scope, not just gay and lesbian, but it was included, and to my amazement, it won. It didn't get me anything. It sent maybe a few extra copies sold. But the book itself is primarily the story of the actual trial and what occurred during the trial and the shenanigans that the government engaged in during the trial. So in that regard, I needed to get the transcripts of my court-martial. And getting the transcripts of my court-martial that I could use verbatim in this book was itself a bit of a challenge. And because the government was not complying with freedom of information and all those sorts of requests, I called up Tammy Baldwin. And Tammy got on the horn, and this is when she was a congressperson, I guess. I don't know. Was she in Congress in 1999? She must have been. And 98, I guess she first went. So then I contacted her office, And their office got back to me and said, keep your eyes open. And eventually, I got transcripts of my court-martial. But it took the intervention of a congressperson, in this case, again, Tammy Baldwin. So that book now has been out by 11 years, and I guess I still sell copies hither and yon, because every now and then I get a royalty for like 25 cents.
Do you cash those, or do you keep them?
No, I keep them. I'm exaggerating. The last one I got was for a couple of bucks, you know. And then the other book I have, just very briefly, is about the SS. It's about the SS ideology, and believe it or not, the SS ideology is the real underpinning of this entire process with me and gay rights. The SS, of course, Holocaust perpetrators, and I was so outraged by people who perpetrated the Holocaust. Now, when I was living in Germany, when I was in the military, I actually lived at the post where the SS were educated. I got to meet former SS officers. I ended up drinking with them. I would get them a little bit drunk and would tell me all these stories that the SS engaged in. And that's when I began to learn the full extent of the SS activities. And then when I came to Madison, I might have mentioned this earlier, my academic career at UW-Madison was on the SS. In fact, my dissertation that I wrote for my doctorate is on the SS, and my dissertation is entitled, is entitled The Ideological Origins of the Pursuit of Perfection Within the Nazi SS. And that subject and that content and that notion of perfection that informed the creation of the SS is what has really informed much of my interpretation of anti-gay, anti-black, anti-women, anti-people of color mentality. In other words, a notion of perfection that is exclusive of any other notion except a very rigid, hard, anti-Enlightenment notion, which not only the SS, of course, developed to perfection, if you will, no pun intended, but also which is, I think, pretty common in our culture, even though some people may not recognize it as so. But that's a bit of Western European intellectual history, which has fascinated me for 40 years. And that's what the dissertation was. But in concluding about these books, they also really informed my books, my conferences I've been to, all the things I've done. It informed among friends. It informed my stuff at Edgewood, even to this very day, where I teach courses on the modern Middle East and American foreign policy. All this stuff is informed by an understanding of some of the dark side of the Western European counter-enlightenment experience. And I understand this phenomenon through the two greatest instructors, of course, George Massey and Bob Kahle, who shared with me everything they could that they knew about sort of the dark side of Western culture.
Jay, just a couple more things.
Sure.
Do you have a few minutes?
Sure.
Okay. So my last official question is just basically to ask you about Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Okay.
So however you want to address it, because it's really, I mean, you were court-martialed out of the Army, and now within the last couple years we've seen a revision. Well, we saw Don't Ask, Don't Tell as you started at Edgewood, sort of, and now after 20-some-odd years in Edgewood, we have the revision of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Right.
So I don't know if you want to just sort of comment on maybe we'll do it this way, how you felt when you started to hear the rumblings that it was going to be rescinded or revised, whatever verb we want to use. And
I suspected from way back when it wouldn't stand forever. Now, I wasn't quite sure when this would happen, and of course I was pleased. I was happy to know that something that we had started, we collectively, we were a small group of people way back in the day, pushing almost 40 years ago, to publicly call and Len Matlevich, he's unfortunately not alive, he was the first to challenge the regulations. I was the first to challenge the UCMJ, so our two cases were actually put together by the ACLU. We knew it would be a long slog, if you will, a long slosh. I didn't know when it would ever happen. I'm glad that it occurred. Now, I have to admit that the issue of the military and my association with it and the nature of how the military is used has always clouded my desire to see Don't Ask, Don't Tell end. And by that I mean I find myself a critic of American foreign policy, and I teach American foreign policy, so maybe I'm sort of conflating all this stuff, but I'm a critic. I tend to be a critic of American foreign policy, and by which I mean I enjoy reading, among other people, Noam Chomsky, and I'm sort of the Chomsky school of American foreign policy. That means that I'm very critical of American military, and I'm critical of our posture in the world. I'm critical of the militarization of domestic and foreign policy. And so why would I go for a gaze in the military? Well, I guess the basic answer why I would support gaze in the military is that I think Americans, by virtue of being Americans, have the right to join the armed forces if they want to, regardless of whether they're gay or not. And because of the way I was treated, I hated it, and I have justified my position of wanting to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because I never wanted anybody to go through this crap again, especially since being gay is an issue that most people don't wake up in the morning and go, hey, Ma, I'm going to be gay today. It doesn't work that way. I'm from the position that homosexuality is somehow related to a deep biological urge, and although I'm not a neurologist or an MD, these are sentiments that go a little bit deeper than just today I'm going to be gay, today I'm going to be straight. So the fact that they're involuntary and that individuals are that way by virtue of who they are seems to me should invalidate any proscriptions about the military. Now, having said that, I supported, of course, ending the ban. I testified against it in 1993. We had court-martial constitutional challenge. But I have always told people, having said that, do you really want to go into an armed forces? Do you really want to go part of a machine that is, on the face of it, construed by many people around the world to be not a voice for liberation of freedom, but just the opposite? Now, I won't go into my politics, but I teach a course on the Middle East where I try and explain to my students that 9/11 was an unfortunate consequence of unfortunate American foreign policy. And as a person who actually was carrying out American foreign policy in the Far East, in Iran of all places, when I was in the military, I could see what the Americans were doing to Iranians who disagreed with American foreign policy. And it wasn't pretty. And they were literally creating enemies of those people who you would think could be our friends. So the long and short of all of this is I was excited that the policy was ending finally. It's a no-nonsense policy. It is as dumb to me as segregation because of race, or segregation or non-acceptance because of gender. It just was a non-issue. But beyond that, I still tell people to be careful and watch out what you support with respect to the armed forces, because the armed forces have been known to be used for less than honorable purposes. Does that make any sense?
Yep, it does.
Okay.
Jay, as always, I want to leave you with the last word. Is there anything on your mind that you'd like to get on the record?
Well, one comment I want to add. You asked me who were one of the people who influenced me, who was gay in the community, and I mentioned a couple. I forgot to mention, I think, David Runyon.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember his name coming up.
Right?
Do you want to talk a little bit about...
Well, I want to make reference to David, because David was always a good friend, and you've probably heard this before. Did you know him?
I did not.
Yeah, David was a good friend. But he came out after he met me, and we used to take long walks. He used to be a Presbyterian minister. And when he came out, oh boy, it was sort of like, huh, this guy was really crazy. But David had a unique capacity to... make you understand that this is using his, I think, Presbyterian ministry technique. He had a way of making things okay if things were sort of rocky. And when I had rocky moments, I would talk to him, and he would facilitate my feeling better. So we used to do a lot of talking, and in fact, he got me to be on his Channel 4, which was the local cable television for public access TV. He had a show that he would come out to my house in Stoughton, and he would film me for an hour talking about his any subject you want, from the war in the Middle East to gays and lesbians to history. I mean, he was adamant. He filmed hours and hours of me. And then these things would be broadcast on local access TV cable 4. I don't know. I forget the name of his show. And this went on for a couple of years, actually. And that's how I got to know David. And so we would spend a lot of time just talking. And it would be, to me, it was never an issue of coming out. I mean, I was out to the universe. But it was always an issue of how you dealt with difficult people, how I could deal with bureaucrats, how I could deal with people who were stonewalling among friends and all that sort of stuff. So he was an important support, I have to admit, during that period. Now, generally, in conclusion, I don't have too much to say. I'm near the end of my career. I found myself not moving beyond gay and lesbian rights. It's still very much part of who I am. But I pretty much have incorporated that experience into my academic life. So now at Edgewood, when I teach, I'm adamant all this stuff is folded into whatever narrative I'm talking about. It is all part of this. And so it has become part of my narrative that I talk about and do it very comfortably. And I think now, in 2012, seeing how the changes that have taken place since my court-martial in 1975, I mean, this is profound. It took longer than I anticipated. God, Lord. And we're not there yet. I mean, we still have the issue of gay marriage. That's something I wish that we could do because of, as I age, my partner and I have been together 25 years, and it would be nice for him to be able to tap into my Social Security or vice versa. But the gains that we have made have been substantial. There's more work to be done. But now is time, I think, to quite frankly pass this legwork onto a younger generation who have a lot of energy. And fortunately for me, I think there are a lot of young men and young women who are really dedicated to fighting the good fight, as they say, and continuing to move gay rights forward until there is as little discrimination as possible. And right now, the big legal one, of course, as I just said, is gay marriage. So that's about it, actually.
All right, Jay, I want to thank you for your time. I want to just confirm one thing with you. I believe it was Nothing to Hide. It was David Runyon's.
Yes, you're correct. Nothing to Hide. Thank you.
Yep. So I want to thank you for your time, and I'll be in touch in terms of getting the release form to you. And if you want, you know, copies of this for your personal history,
okay.
I'll be in touch with you via email probably the next week or so.
Good talking with you, too.
Yep. Have a good day and have a good weekend, and talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.